Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Southern University English professor Robert Azzarello about his new book, 300 Years of Decadence, New Orleans Literature and the Transatlantic World. We'll also revisit Robert Fiesler's Tinderbox, The Upstairs Lounge Fire, and The Rise of Gay Liberation. Robert Azzarello is New Orleans through and through, a graduate of Brother Martin and Loyola University, now an associate professor of English at Southern University of New Orleans. Today, we're talking about his new book, 300 Years of Decadence, New Orleans Literature and the Transatlantic World. Robert, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Decadence means many things in this book. It's a concept that's long been associated with our city. And I think back in 1993, when Richard Sexton and Randolph Delahanty published their book, New Orleans Elegance and Decadence, It kind of became a catchphrase for us. It was like, we look at our falling down houses and we go, oh, elegance and decadence, you know? Or, So tell us where you start with this idea in literary terms.
New Orleans has long been known as a decadent city.
Right.
For many different reasons. Like you said, the houses that are falling down in disrepair still have some spark of beauty.
Yes.
But also just the opulence of some of the Garden District mansions, the elaborate ironwork in the French Quarter. You know, it's almost over the top, you know, and its associations with aristocracy, some undead aristocracy, too, in Anne Rice. And a lot of people, historians in particular, think of decadence as meaning something in particular, as having a stable definition. Decadence is, let's say, beauty in decay.
Right.
But I'm interested in peeling back the layers of what decadence means, kind of to thinking about decadence in many different angles. I think of decadence as being the beauty in decay, but even more philosophically, what I see happening with decadence is what we think of as good and bad don't really hold up as binary oppositions.
Uh-huh.
The good is always morphing into the bad. The bad is always morphing into the good. Or what we think of as good or healthy may not actually be good and healthy. And likewise, what we think of as bad or unhealthy may not actually be bad and unhealthy. In philosophical terms, there's always an axiological shift, a shift in value.
And things are constantly changing.
Right.
Here as everywhere else.
Right.
Now, one of the most moving passages in this book to me, because this is The Reading Life, was that description of Pierre Lassat leaving the city and having to sell his books.
Yes.
That was so lovely when he goes, "There is no memory, no joy, no sorrow in my life in which they had not played some part. They'd followed my fate, and one of its strange aspects was that I had come to the banks of the Mississippi to separate from them." Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yes. Yeah, and it's so good on so many levels.
It is.
Yeah, I mean, he has such an attachment to his books. And of course, you and I have this attachment. I think everybody in the room would have these attachments to the physical object. And when you do have to get rid of them for one reason or another, it does feel like a great loss, a great psychological loss. I love the way that he sort of describes his books as friends.
Oh, I do too.
But then a little darker interpretation too is that they're his property.
Mm-hmm.
And this, you know, goes back to the whole history of slavery too, how a lot of owners thought of their objects as both friends and property.
Right.
That's another layer that sort of comes up with the Lassat passage.
It was so lovely to read that. That was just like, oh, Because, you know, this is a climate notoriously unkind book. So.
Yes, yes.
Now, you explore many, many different books, and mm-hmm. from the beginning of New Orleans to books of this moment, practically. Let's talk about two of the historical writers that I think are so interesting that you write about. And one, of course, is George Washington Cable, mm-hmm. who I think never gets enough attention, really.
Yeah. Well, he is the most famous writer.
But we don't think of him as a decadent writer.
No.
Not at all.
No.
So.
No, not at all. And many of my readings, I will call them imaginative close mm-hmm. readings. I often read against the grain of the text. And I find little tidbits of decadence and kind of expand on them or elaborate on them. But the novel, The Grandissime, seems to me to be about a decadence kind of conceived in evolutionary terms. And we have to remember, too, this is right after Darwin's big breakthrough.
Uh-huh.
And many of the families seem to be falling into disrepair. The family line is sort of disintegrating in very sort of Darwinian evolutionary ways. They're losing their fitness, in a sense. So you're right. Cable isn't often thought of as a decadent writer, but I think some of the concerns with degeneration, with decline, with sort of impending catastrophe, all relate to decadence.
Mm-hmm. We live with impending catastrophe all
the Yes. time. Yes, we do.
Another writer that I love so much anyway is Lafcadio Hearn.
Oh, he's the best.
He's one of the greatest yeah. characters yes. among our literary figures there ever was, don't you think?
Yes, yes.
So talk about his work for you.
And he is his pure and simple decadent. You know, pure and simple. Not only is it thematically decadent, where you see these images of decay, which he just romanticizes and eroticizes and sensualizes, but the style of the writing, the form of the writing is decadent. The sentence structure is over the top. You know, long sentences, heavily punctuated, that sort of meander around. I mean, that to me is the decadent sentence. We could talk about decadence as a theme, but we can also talk about decadence
as a style
of sentences. Lafcadio Hearn is one of the few who sort of weave those two together.
So do you read everything through this lens now? I can see you reading Maurice Carlos Ruffin's mm-hmm. We Cast a Shadow and thinking, decadent, you know what I mean?
Well, once you start to read decadently, it's yeah. hard to get out of it.
So
it
what really do you is. Want readers to take away with them? What skill or what insight is key for you?
Well, the first thing is to recognize the rich literary history that we have here.
Right.
And a lot of times we don't recognize that. I didn't recognize it. You know, I grew up in New Orleans, and in high school we read Kate Chopin, but that's the only New Orleans literature that I had read until I started working on this book in 2012.
Wow.
And so the whole world sort of opened up. Yeah, because my PhD was in American literature, but it was also a lot to do with European philosophy. Mm-hmm. It was in New York, you know, so my mind in New York was not my mind in New Orleans.
So Robert Azzarello comes home.
Yes.
In many ways.
Yeah.
You end with a chapter about current writers. Some very interesting writers, I think. John Biganay, of course.
Yeah. Well, I had been reading John Biganay for quite a while. He was a professor at Loyola mm-hmm. When I was there. I had never taken a class with him, but I was always familiar with his work. His short stories teach really well. The students really get into his short fiction. After Katrina, he started on his Katrina trilogy. I saw the first play, I think it was at the CAC, Rising Water, and of course was just blown away by it. I read the three plays once they were published. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, he is the essential playwright for the Katrina catastrophe. And any approach to New Orleans literature needs to talk about him in one way or another. It's incredibly difficult because it's incredibly sad, the story that he's dealing with. I remember reading one of the plays and not being able to talk for the rest of the day.
One of the best things you say in this book at the very end, which I'm holding very close to my heart, which is, one must remember, too, that New Orleans has never been destroyed in its 300-year history.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very encouraging note to end on.
Yes, it is. It is. Yes, we have incredible problems. The past can teach us that all of the catastrophes, Valerie Martin calls it a series of catastrophes. History is a series of catastrophes, that still human life has this will to survive, but also a will to make meaning.
Yes.
The will to make meaning is sort of the foundation for the will to survive. This is what literature does.
And thank goodness for it. Yeah. I mean, well, this is a brilliant, brilliant, rich book that you need to read more than once, I have to say.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Robert Azzarello, whose new book is 300 Years of Decadence, New Orleans Literature and the Transatlantic World. Robert, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
In celebration of Pride Month, we're revisiting my 2018 interview with Robert Fiesler, author of Tinderbox, The Untold Story of the Upstairs Lounge Fire and the Rise of Gay Liberation. Tinderbox, which has recently been reissued in paperback, won an Edgar Award for Best Fact Crime and was also the winner of Lambda Literary's Judith A. Markowitz Award for Emerging LGBTQ Writers. Robert Fiesler is a journalist, a graduate of the Columbia School of Journalism who works in Boston. Today we're talking about his first book, Tinderbox, The Untold Story of the Upstairs Lounge Fire and the Rise of Gay Liberation. Robert Fiesler, welcome to The Reading Life.
Happy to be here, Susan.
Now, the Upstairs Lounge Fire, for listeners who may not know, was a terrible tragedy. It was the arson of a French Quarter gay bar in 1973 that claimed the lives of 32 people. So, Bobby, what was it that led you to go back to this event and reexamine it in such detail?
It was almost like this event found me. So I was expressing to two Columbia Journalism School professors while I was a student there that I was interested in writing a book that took a look at the early nascent phase of the gay rights movement when it was called Gay Liberation.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the professors was named Nicholas Lemon, who had grown up in New Orleans and had spent some time there as a baby reporter for a publication that was then an alt-weekly in the French Quarter called the Vieux Carré Courier. And he said, had you ever heard about this event called the Upstairs Lounge Fire? And I said, I had not. And he said he had done some reporting in the summer of 1973 around that event, but he'd never really touched on or reported that event specifically. He recalled how his mentor, Bill Rushton, who was then a very famous French Quarter character, activist, played all sorts of roles, wore many hats, similar to in the great lineage of French Quarter characters. And he recalled how his mentor, Bill Rushton, had reported on the Upstairs Lounge Fire for an extended period of time. And then I tried to ask Professor Lemon any more questions he could recall, and he said he couldn't. He said it was strange. There was almost a very hazy understanding of it. And it was the first time when I was interacting with him that he expressed this inability to articulate what was going on. Professor Lemon's the kind of guy that oftentimes can remember year to year what he ate for dinner on a certain night. There was something interesting culturally going on that had caused a kind of mass forgetfulness, if you will, or something that had overarchingly resulted in this event not becoming top of mind, even for him, who was an individual who took a very early and very interesting look at the gay rights phenomenon nationally and in New Orleans. So, of course, I had to find out more.
You take a lot of pains to create the lives of those you knew were at the fire. And readers come to know them as real characters, real people. And we come to care about them and their lives. And you spent a lot of time talking with survivors, researching the lives of those who were lost in the fire. Talk about that process of getting people to talk about this event.
Sure. I mean, that was a tremendous challenge, but also a very important challenge. I wanted each of these men's and women's lives to feel consequential to the reader. From a nonfiction perspective and from a journalistic perspective, I saw in the story of the Upstairs Lounge the need, at least in this narrative, to rebuild and reconstruct the historic closet. Really, that had erased a lot of these men's lives and a lot of these men's stories. Even prior to the fire, a lot of these men lived in a kind of invisible state, in a kind of uniquely idiosyncratic closeted life. So I wanted to give, in some sense, voice to the voiceless, which I guess is the purpose of what a lot of journalists seek to do. And I wanted to bring to the forefront what their day-to-day experiences were like. What were the kind of lives that they were forced to lead in a society where, because of an innate characteristic, they had become criminals? Something that they couldn't help, right, had kind of shunted them into a criminalized subgroup. And how did they live? What were their lives like? The answer was they lived very carefully, but they also lived very fascinatingly rich lives. And I wanted to highlight these were lives that were full of joy, and oftentimes surprisingly. And I wanted to bring to the surface what the day-to-day existence of a closeted gay man would have been like at that period of time in 1973. Just so a reader could see the incredible triumphs and tragedies and the incredible of these individuals and the incredible manner in which a gay man living an out lifestyle, even in a semi-out lifestyle, had overcome so much just to get to the Upstairs Lounge and be present at a beer bust at the busiest, most bustling night of the week of a popular bar on the night of June 24th, 1973. So it was important to me that their lives felt consequential in the narrative because they were consequential per se.
Well, I think of that young soldier who drove every weekend to come to the Upstairs Lounge from Texas because it was that important to him to have this life.
Yes. New Orleans had played a very important part in his coming out process. He'd made one of his best friends, Stuart Butler, who's still kicking around New Orleans. After the Upstairs Lounge, in the wake of it, became quite a locally famous and actually regionally famous gay activist. For Stephen, New Orleans had a very important role in his private persona. And the distance between his closeted existence in San Antonio, it was actually Randolph, Texas, where he served at Randolph Air Force Base. The eight-hour drive between that military base and New Orleans put some miles in distance and allowed him to live his two lives. And New Orleans has had a long and storied tradition of serving the needs of closeted gay servicemen in that it was a place where they could find community and be among friends without a vast array of professional and personal consequence.
And how hard was it for you to get the survivors to talk to you about this?
It depends. Some were overarchingly eager to tell their stories because it was part of their healing process. There has been several very, very worthy tellings of this event thus far. And some of the survivors have told their story again and again now to the point where I feel it is part of the way they heal.
Uh-huh.
It's important for them to tell and retell the story as many times as possible because they want other people to know what happened, what it was like, what their experience was. There are others who, because of the nature of the trauma and because of the state of closeted society in 1973, were psychological and psychiatric counseling was not made available. And even if it was made available, there was a widespread fear and bias in that in 1973, the American Psychiatric Association, DSM, still listed homosexuality as a sexual deviancy disorder. So there was a fear to seek out that help. And because of that, a lot of the survivors have, over the years and decades, managed in their own ways. In some ways, they have not.
Mm-hmm.
So in those cases, you're facing individuals with, justifiably so, a psyche that is wounded in this specific regard, and an individual who does not want to delve into the darkness of what they experienced in that span of time. And for those individuals, it was a very careful and sensitive dance to the point where I understood if they didn't wish to speak. And there were some individuals for whom it's so painful that they still, 4.5 decades later, cannot delve into what happened in those minutes. And for others, the prolonged dance, sometimes for up to 3 years at a span of time, enabled a kind of trusting relationship to be developed. And from there, we were able to eventually sit down and have that conversation where they were able to relate their experiences in a way that felt healing to them.
One of the things that is, I think, most heartbreaking about your story is the lack of religious solace for these people, the difficulty they had in finding a place even to worship and come together. And so many of the victims were bound together by their participation in the same church.
Correct, yes. Many of the victims, about a third of the Upstairs Lounge victims, were members of a gay-affirming Christian denomination called the Metropolitan Community Church, which had been founded in Los Angeles in 1968 by a leader named Troy Perry, who by 1973 was one of the most visible faces for homosexuality in the country. And the members of the MCC of New Orleans had spent about 2 years together building up a kind of Christian fellowship. That Sunday, June 24th, 1973, a group of those men had held a religious service, and following that service, they decided to celebrate some additional fellowship and spend some more time together by spending the evening at the Upstairs Lounge. And unfortunately, of that congregation of 30 men, about 10 perished, including the deacon and the pastor of that specific church. So in essence, that congregation was gutted by the fire. Following the events of that night, the next morning, Troy Perry, the founding pastor to the Metropolitan Community Church, who was then in Los Angeles helping his own congregation celebrate Pride Weekend — that weekend was National Pride Weekend — heard about the Upstairs Lounge and immediately sprung into action, alerted his national network, and then flew to New Orleans to try to help his grieving congregation, which had been destroyed, and to also help the community become aware of the fire that occurred just in town. And Troy Perry met with, and as my book delves into, I should say, a very mixed reaction. He did meet with some allies who were willing to help him take up the banner to, again, help the public become cognizant of this terrible disaster that had occurred on the border of the French Quarter. But also, he was an outsider who had a message that was considered very radical for the time period, which was he was a proponent of sexual openness and gay liberation, and he was a homosexual Christian, which was considered radical and really unthinkable for the time period among the major denominations who would not accept such an identity. And therefore, Troy Perry was oftentimes labeled in his press conferences that he held in New Orleans and in the events that he helped stage throughout over the course of the week that followed the Upstairs Lounge fire, he was often called a fairy carpetbagger.
Writing this book must have taken such a personal toll for you. But how did it advance your writing life? What did it do for you as a writer to make sense of this story and place it in context?
Yeah, this book allowed me to gain access to a gay world that no longer exists. It allowed me to meet men and women who participated in this underground society at a time when homosexuality held great personal risk, when it really meant something to be who you were at that span of time, and especially to be open about it. And so I would say gaining access to that now destroyed gay world that was in essence destroyed by not just the Upstairs Lounge fire, but by the AIDS crisis and by just the march of time, allowed me a window into what gay liberation was like when it was nascent, when it was just getting started, and when people were just, in essence, fighting for the right to exist against the public that did not want to hear it.
And here we are, 45 years later, and yeah. I understand that congratulations are in order because you were recently married.
Oh my gosh, yes. Absolutely.
Which is something magical.
Yes, it was. Absolutely, it was. It was incredibly emotional, and especially against the context of the Upstairs Lounge. It was... It was hard for me to place those two events together because you're correct. The times have changed so dramatically. We no longer live with the closet as a governing institution, and the march of gay liberation from the 1970s, which eventually became the gay and lesbian movement, you know, in the late 1970s, early 80s, which became the LGB movement, or the lesbian, gay, bisexual movement, and then eventually the LGBT movement, eventually the LGBTQ movement. The progression of it is almost unfathomable in terms of the level of social change and ideological change that's occurred for the average person in that span of time.
This book is such an important document in the chronicle of that struggle. We've been talking with Robert Fiesler about Tinderbox, the untold story of the Upstairs Lounge fire and the rise of gay liberation. You can meet Robert Fiesler when he appears in conversation with New Orleans artist and Upstairs Lounge historian Skylar Fine and signs the paperback of Tinderbox, The Upstairs Lounge Fire and the Rise of Gay Liberation, Wednesday, June 26th at 6 at the Main Library, 219 Loyola Avenue. This discussion commemorates the 46th anniversary of the Upstairs Lounge Fire and the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Riots. Bobby, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Tubby and Coo's Mid-City Bookshop presents Amanda Montell, author of Word Slut, a feminist guide to taking back the English language, Sunday, June 23rd from 1 to 3, at Reading Between the Wines at Pearl Wine Company, 3700 Orleans Avenue. Narrative, N4, in partnership with the New Orleans Museum of Arts, Art and Letters series, presents an extraordinary night of music and literature, Sunday, June 23rd at 6:30 at NOMA. 8 international authors will read excerpts of their work, accompanied by a musical composition created to match the piece and the author's home region. The writers include Man Booker Prize-winning author Marlon James from Jamaica, National Book Award-winning author Colin McCann from Ireland, Sierra Club John Muir awardee Terry Tempest Williams from Utah, New York Times bestselling author Ishmael Bea from Sierra Leone, former Louisiana State Poet Laureate Daryl Bourke, Irish novelist Ruth Gilligan, Persian and Paris-based author Lila Azam Zangani, and PEN awardee Rob Spillman from New York. Zydeco superstar Bruce Sunpie Barnes of New Orleans will compose the musical pieces. He'll be joined on stage by Colm McConney Omari, famed violinist from the Irish band The Frames, along with the New Orleans Brass Band and other local musicians. The event's free and open to the public, but RSVP at education@noma.org or call 504-658-4128. Doors open at 6:30. S. Derby Gisclair, author of Early Baseball in New Orleans, A History of 19th Century Play, discusses his book at 7, Tuesday, June 25th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Art of the City Book Club at the Historic New Orleans Collection, 520 Royal Street, continues with Anne Gislason, author of The Futilitarians, Our Year of Thinking, Drinking, Grieving, and Reading, in conversation with artist Michael Dees, whose work appears in the exhibition. I'll facilitate the event, Wednesday, June 26th at 6 at 520 Royal Street. Robert Fiesler appears in conversation with New Orleans artist Skylar Fine and signs the paperback of Tinderbox, The Upstairs Lounge Fire, and The Rise of Gay Liberation, Wednesday, June 26th at 6 at the Main Library, 219 Loyola Avenue. This discussion commemorates the 46th anniversary of the Upstairs Lounge Fire and the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Riots. Jonathan Klein and Anna Tattleman are the featured readers at Fiction Night in the Bloodjet Poetry Series, Wednesday, June 26th at 7:30 at the Dragonfly, 3921 St. Claude Avenue. And poet Kelly Harris, Literary Outreach Coordinator for Poets and Writers, Inc., hosts an information session about resources for local writers from Poets and Writers. That's Thursday, June 27th from 6:30 to 7:30 at the Rosa Keller Branch Library and Community Center. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.